Hello, and welcome to Looks Unfamiliar, the show that remembers the Jack and Ori's 1984 presentation of Betsy Byers' teen love triangle novel, The Civil War, was read, yes, it did happen, was read by perennial American actor in the UK, David Baxt. I'm Tim Worthington, and joining me today to talk about some of the things that she remembers, that nobody else ever seems to, is book reviewer Joanne Shepherd. Jo, what are you up to? Where can we find it?
You can find me on various social media, Twitter and Blue Sky, if you can't bear Twitter anymore. I'm on Blue Sky, where I'm Red Sky at night. And I also have a book reviews blog, which is called Breakfast at Libraries.
OK, well, let's move straight into your first choice, which is a show that I think possibly a lot of the sort of people that you get replying to you on social media might have been very much in favour of. Okay, I can't believe I found that. That's the theme there from Go For It. It should have given you some idea what the show's like, but Joe, what was it?
So Go For It was, I think this programme had sort of two incarnations, and I think the second one had a slightly different format. But the version I remember, it was hosted by a bloke called Robbie Vincent, who used to be a DJ on, I think it was Radio London or GLR, whichever it was at the time. I particularly remember him because for some reason my dad really hated him, and I never kind of, it was, you know, when sometimes your parents have an irrational dislike of someone quite innocuous. Robbie Vincent was one of my dad's, and it was, the programme was a really sort of, it was kind of a very worthy educational health and fitness programme, which sort of pitted two very ordinary parents and two kids' families against one another to see who could improve their lifestyle. And because it was the 80s, like, that normally involved giving up smoking, like all the parents like smoke like chimneys. And people were sort of weighed a lot, and there always seemed to be a bit where someone sort of had to show them how to use an exercise bike or something like that, and there would be sort of footage of them going for a brisk stroll, and everyone would be wearing like matching tracksuits. What I particularly remember, when I think now about the kind of diet and fitness programs that sort of turned up on television post 2000, it's just so different, because now you would have, I'm thinking of things like, there was around about sort of 2010, 2015-ish, there was a program called Fat Families, which basically entailed someone going around to some fat people's houses and just being incredibly horrible to them and sort of calling them massive fatties. And there'll be lots of shots of like zooming in on their belly when they're standing there in their pants. And it was all quite cruel and quite extreme. Whereas Go For It was the absolute antithesis of that, because it was no nonsense, but it was so kind of sensible and gentle and sort of, you know, the message being that, you know, small changes. So at the end of each show, invariably the parents would let the kids down with the scoring because they could never quite manage to give up on the fags, basically. And it would say, well, you know, you didn't quite manage to completely give up smoking, but, you know, well done, because you've cut down from 40 a day to 30 and you've moved on to silk cut, and they are lower in tar, so we're going to give you 5 points for that.
Well, can you imagine them even acknowledging smoking on, not even the programme, like, there's any programme now.
Yeah, and also smoking in the house around your children as well. There would always be shots of them all like sat on the sofa, and the parents would have like, you know, have a like an 8-year-old next to them, right? But they'd be like puffing away on an embassy filter. You'd never see that on television now. And the other thing I remember is that they never seemed to have like proper, they always had tracksuits, but they never seemed to have like proper trainers and things. And it would always be, because it was all about like, you know, being able to just fit a bit of exercise into your daily lifestyle. They'd always be like doing really like high impact aerobic exercises in the front room, just wearing like unstructured plimp socks. Probably the parents always ended up with like really bad knee injuries or something. It was very sort of, it had that whole, but I suppose it's from the same era as when you used to get like Mad Lizzie,
yes,
or Mr. Motivator on GMTV doing a little 5-minute workout, a very easy 5-minute workout in the mornings, and that was supposed to completely transform you. It was very much that sort of vibe, I would say.
Well, that was its fundamental problem, as I remember it, was that it was, as the theme tune emphasised in great detail, it was about putting a little bit in to get a little bit out. It's the era of keep fit,
yes,
inverted commas, and as you say, Mad Lizzie, yes, and the idea that just sort of occasionally bending up and down, holding the back of a chair, could turn you into some sort of Steve-O vet figure. But the thing was, they never made anything look like fun because it was all framed around sort of go-getting people who were already fitter than you telling you what to do, dashing off in their pastel tracksuits and saying, haven't you caught up with me yet? It was that sort of vibe. And I felt really sorry for the families. They were being almost shamed in front of the nation. I mean, it's their own fault for wanting to go onto television so badly that they went on Go For It. But I still had a little bit of, it's not very fair.
No, I used to think it was a bit like sort of having your PE teacher with you all the time. Because the exercise thing were always very kind of school PE type exercises. It was never anything like, they never went to like a fun exercise. They never went to like a boxing class or like a fun exercise class. It was always like, right, some star jumps and, like you say, like bending over while holding the back of a chair or something. It was always really sort of very kind of old school exercises from the 1950s that are actually sort of probably quite bad for you. Also, the eating thing, like now, if there was a program like that now, the eating thing would be like, oh, well, you know, they have takeaways 3 times a week. Whereas then it was more that they were having, again, because it was the 80s, they were sort of having beef burger, chips and beans for their tea and stuff like that. It was all very sort of its time. And they'd always be like scenes of them like sitting there tucking into a massive pie or something. But I don't really remember anyone being like massively overweight. They weren't like, they would just sort of look like just normal people to
bloke
me.
Down pub dads, basically.
Yeah, yeah, dad with a bit of a belly, you know, like a normal dad. There weren't people that would get their bum filmed by a BBC news crew doing a piece about obesity. They weren't like that level of fat. They were just kind of normal, you know, classic dad and mum who are quite busy and middle-aged, you know, and the kids were never fat. Kids will probably grow up with a complex.
Well, there were 2 major elements to the show that only I seem to remember. One is that there always be a celebrity fitness spot where it's a little filmed insert where it'd be something like, say, Mike Harding walking in the Pennine Hills. Well, what a surprise. But, you know, it would be kind of, it wasn't really, I mean, in the broadest general sense, it was exercise. It wasn't showing you how to do an exercise as such. It was just, here is what this celebrity does. And it was more just a little bit of a chat in the middle of it. The other thing is, I'm convinced this ended every episode. It was a sort of crime watch reconstruction photo fit building up with a voiceover describing this crime that it later became apparent was Sir Walter Raleigh introducing the potato and sugar and so on into the UK. And then it finally sort of formalises him and said, yes, Sir Walter Raleigh, you've got a lot to answer for. I mean, talk about blaming the past for the present.
Yeah, it's very much, it is very much his fault that we all like chips, isn't it? Like, it's really... Let's blame him.
Oh, when they came back from the voyage, where they were singing, hopeth it's chips, it's chips. Hopeth it doth be chips. I don't know how they talked in his day. I think I was put off listening to anything about him ever by that stupid photo fit satire.
Ludicrous. Ludicrous. It was so BBC and so kind of educational and so sort of public service. Everything like in that sort of way. It did feel, it felt like a schools programme, like for adults to me.
And also, it was one of the very last things in that sort of half five slot that they could never work out what to do with until Neighbours was installed in there very shortly after Go For It.
Yeah.
If you look at what everyone remembers, there was Master Team, the Angela Rippon quiz show, there was Charles in Charge with Scott Baio, there was Gloria, that sitcom nobody remembers, it seemed to last for about 8 years, and another show which we might well be talking about at some point in the not too distant future, but it was a fish out of water even in that slot, I think. It was not Ask the Family.
Yeah, because I think the things that used to be on in that slot, like you say, there were things like Master Team, were kind of things that kids might watch after they'd watched the kids' stuff, and then you might watch it with your mum just before you were having your tea. But I don't think Go For It, really. I suppose there was a family element to it, but it was just, yeah, it was, like you said, it was a
there's
very
nothing
much a
for kids in it at all.
No, no, there's no, I mean, God knows why I watched it, probably because it was the 80s and there was nothing else on.
You didn't want to go for a run.
Yeah. I watched it instead of doing exercise, probably.
The chair was right there. You could have held the back of it.
I could have just run up and down stairs a few times. That was another thing they were always obsessed with. Taking stairs instead of getting lifts. No one's going to lose weight like once a week going up some stairs.
Do you remember what the prizes were on it?
No. Were they exercise-based prizes? Were they like gym equipment or something like that? It would surprise me because it was very...
Everyone got a Go For It rucksack. So obviously get straight out with Mike Harding. But the winning family got a Go For It breadboard. Now, I'm saying mixed signals there.
A bread... Also, a breadboard. Like, even if it was health related, that would still be the dullest prize anyone has ever won on anything. A breadboard. Christ. I'd forgotten that. Bloody hell. That's poor, isn't it? That is BBC budget, isn't it? Breadboard.
But you are right. It did come back in, I think, in 1989 on Sundays, because obviously there was no Moving Neighbours for it, with Gloria Hunniford in a glossier format. It seemed to mainly involve sitting down on a big sofa and talking about fitness things you might do. It's like, here's Cleo Brokos to talk about lifting. You know those really small plastic weights in sort of fluorescent colours that were for women in the
80s? Yeah, and you would always be told that if you didn't have any weights, you could just use two tins of baked beans. It's like, that weighs about 500 grams. That's not going to help you. Gloria Hunniford, again, she's a very sort of worthy kind of presenter, motherly. I can see why they chose her, because, again, same sort of slightly telling you what to do sort of vibe.
Okay, well, moving on to your next choice now, who, although he's a dog, I think the presenters that go for it might have had something to say about his personal hygiene. A compass team, a kitchen mum, an old fur coat with a bird on top, a moving mass of unpleasantness. Okay, the second theme there, we're coming back to that, from What a Mess, a famous literary dog that's so famous that it took me ages to find that out. So, Joe, who was he and what was going on there?
What a Mess was a series of children's books, a celeb-penned children's book franchise, but written by Frank Muir. And because it was written by Frank Muir, it was sort of genuinely really funny. They were kind of picture books, and What a Mess himself was an Afghan hound puppy. If people aren't familiar with what an Afghan hound looks like, they're very tall, very sort of slender, really elegant dogs with like long silky
Andre
fur.
Andre Agassi in dog form.
Very similar, yeah, long nose. If you think of when you get like a Vogue fashion shoot where there's a model standing outside with two dogs on a lead outside a big country house, like they would probably be like Afghan hounds. Very, very glamorous dogs. But the big joke being with What a Mess was that he was a puppy and he was sort of very, really short and fat and just an absolute like disaster in every way. So he's really, really clumsy. He's always covered in something kind of sticky, or he's fallen in some mud. And in the illustrations, which are great, he's always got like bits of twigs and leaves stuck in his fur, and there might be like some flies buzzing around him.
Wasn't there a duck always on top of his head as well?
There were often things on his head. That's partly because the illustrations were very, they were just incredible. Like, the illustrations in their own right were great, because they always had loads of like other things going on in the pictures that had nothing to do with the story. So if What a Mess like fell into a pond, which he would do, there would be a picture of underwater and there'd be sort of little tiny kind of frog-like people in a submarine or something that wouldn't be ever mentioned in the text. It would just be in the background, or in the background of a picture there might just be some like little tiny aliens descending from a flying saucer, or someone might have a cupboard open and there'd be like a little community of gnomes or something living in there. And these things were never mentioned in the books. You just sort of spotted them in the pictures and you could spend ages looking for them, and which I loved. So yeah, very off-kilter children's franchise, I would say. And the other thing about What a Mess was that he's got this sort of whole confusion around his own identity, because his name isn't What a Mess. He's got like a sort of Croftsy style kennel club name, like something like Crown Prince Aziz of Kashmir, or
it's Prince Amir of Kinjal.
Amir. That's it. So he's got that sort of name, but he genuinely thinks his name is What a Mess, because that's all he ever hears people say when they see him. And at one point he doesn't know he's an Afghan hound, because he doesn't look like one. He's sort of small and fat and shabby looking. And I think at one point he thinks he's like a bee or something like that. He's not sure exactly what he is. And I just, as a child, I just found them hysterically funny. But I don't remember like any of my friends reading them. I mean, I love dogs, so maybe they were probably bought for me because I was so into dogs and love kind of dogs and puppies. And also I was a sort of kid that probably always had like a bit of twig stuck in my hair, so maybe I kind of identified with him. But yeah, I don't remember anyone else really reading them.
Well, I can kind of support that, because my recollection of my exposure to What a Mess was that I would say the books were popular without being popular in the way sort of similar books would be now. They weren't right. sort of shoved in your face all the time. It was just they sold well and that was good enough for everyone. Because I remember being aware that What a Mess was a thing before the series was on. Now, not the series that theme was from, I'll come back to that, but there was an earlier one in 1979 made by Small Films.
Oh.
In their weird kind of towards the end with a Small Films period where they didn't really, you know, they were remaking Ivor the Engine and Knock and the Nog and all kinds of lower scale things that eventually leading up to Totty, the Story of a Doll's House, which if anyone is shuddering when I mention that, go and listen to the episode with Juliette Brando because her recollections of it will say it all for you. But that was put out by the BBC over Christmas in 1979, right at the end of the children's schedules in the morning. So, you know, it was in amongst Battle of the Planets and Play Chess and so on. This weird little esoteric cartoon, which I think, because, I mean, it's disappeared completely now. When I say that, you know, it probably does still exist somewhere, but nobody's cared enough to dig it out. Mm. But I think it was like rostrum camera animation of the original illustrations with a theme by, if I'm correct about this, Andrew Lloyd Webber. And the sort of plaintive synthy theme. Because he did do a lot of... That was before he got really, really big. And he did do a lot of children's BBC stuff. People forget that.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He was forever on Blue Peter and Ask Aspel and so on. It absolutely came and went, despite being linked to what you would think of now as a popular book franchise. Mm. So that shows the limit. And I do remember as well, when that was on, for some reason we couldn't go in. We had to walk past Wilson's, which is a big independent bookstore in Liverpool, which I really, really miss. Frank Muir and What a Mess were in there, to quote me at the time, making friends. And we didn't get to go in and see them. I think somebody in the What a Mess costume was shaking hands with kids. To me, that qualified as making friends with them.
I would have loved to have met Frank Muir and got a signed What a Mess book. Because I remember, I only have the very, very vaguest memory of the TV series. I remember there being one, but I can't really sort of picture it in my head. Or, like, I didn't remember the theme tune. I must have been really tiny when that was on. But I do remember, I mean, I did love the books. I was always getting them out of the library. They were the ones I would sort of get again and again. And my mum would be like, you've got What a Mess out again. I'd be like, yeah, it's great. And I have really, really fond memories of What a Mess. And I don't know why it's not endured, because it was brilliant.
Well, there were three series, actually, because there was a late 80s one, which that kind of Beverly Sisters theme that I played at the top of this came
from.
Yeah,
I don't remember
which
that one
was actually proper. The animated, that was ITV, that one. I think it might have been the start of the children's ITV schedules when we would have been at school anyway.
At
the very least coming back from school. Also, there was a mid-90s American one where they had loads of different characters with different voices. And as far as I'm concerned, that's not canon.
No, that's unacceptable.
It needed Frank Muir narrating it, who, I will say, when you look back, is a really fascinating figure, because it was like nobody seemed to know what to do with him. He'd been obviously really successful, you know, in the post-war era with Take It From Here and My Word and My Music. But my recollection of him, it's sort of in the late 70s and early 80s, was that in the same day he would be on, say, well, obviously he was on Call My Bluff a lot, but that was what dads watched.
That was
later on when they talked about Words. But, you know, you would see him on, say, in the same day he'd be on The Book Programme and Swap Shop. So he was half for intellectuals, half for kids. And he himself, I didn't know until recently, you know, he affected the era like this kind of wry, retired military man with his immaculate bow tie. He was actually a proper Cockney kid.
Really? I didn't know that.
I was educated in E10, not Eton, was one of his standard jokes.
I had no idea.
It's a brilliant gag.
I had no idea. I always think of him as being someone who, when I was a child, was just always on panel games. And would kind of, he was the sort of person that would kind of be on, like, Wogan for no real reason. He wouldn't be plugging anything, but he'd just always be really good value. So he was one of those people like Beryl Reid, who was always being on Chat Show, or Peter Ustinov, who would just be on because they were just an effortless raconteur. So he would always be on things like that.
And he was always in the top left slot on Blankety Blank if it wasn't Bill Tardy or Winnie Rushton saying, well, Terry, we're both men of the world.
Yeah, and if you were on Blankety Blank, you would absolutely choose him for the Supermatch game because he would be a sensible one to choose.
He was erudite as it went in those days.
He wouldn't scupper you for the sake of getting a laugh, and he wouldn't be thick, like a lot of the contestants on Blankety Blank seem to be. So he would be, he would always be a really good stalwart of programmes like that, as you say, like Willie Rushton. I only really remember him as a child from panel games and adverts. I don't really remember him. I do remember him on My Music, but he was on a lot of adverts, wasn't he?
He was, because he did. Well, first of all, it was him with the Humphreys in the 70s, which, you know, was supposed to get you drinking more milk by making you frightened.
By terrifying milk, you.
Which, but he also did Cadbury's Fruit and Nut with the Everyone's a fruit and nut case.
Yes, yes.
And also Bachelor Savory Rice with the tagline, "Each grain will drive them insane." So that's just from an Iron Maiden song. But he also did one of the, well, so one of the last things he did was, you know, he kept working beyond things like This Morning for years afterwards and was still writing books. But I think one of the last actual vehicles he had was, I think it was in 1992, Channel 4 did a series called TV Heaven, where he linked, you know, the sort of shows that hadn't been seen in years by that point. Like there'd be sort of an additional world in action, sort of like The Strange World of Gurney Slade. And I seem to remember at least a bit of the Penguins and other small films production. That's weird as well, because that is something you would get nowadays. He says, as somebody who does appear on a lot of clip shows, people who don't really have much to say about what they talk about doing it, but they'd obviously got him in because he remembered those eras and had anecdotes about
them. Yeah, and he used to write with Dennis Norden, didn't he? They were like a writing partner.
He did, yes, yeah.
And I sort of think of them as being quite similar characters as well, in that they would just sort of appear on things. I mean, obviously, I remember Dennis Norden doing It Will Be All Right on the Night, holding his clipboard and things like that. And I once saw him shopping in John Lewis in Brent Cross Shopping Centre. So I remember him from Brent Cross. But again, he would also sort of appear on a lot of kind of panel shows and things, but didn't really sort of do much else. Or certainly not much that was visible.
He did present Looks Familiar, which gave the show its
name.
Did
he? I'd forgotten that was Norden. I've done Dennis a disservice. Sorry, Dennis.
Just before we move on, I want to give a quick shout out for What a Mess's nemesis, the cat next door. Just because, I mean, you could have less obviously copied Custard. That's all I'm saying.
I'd actually forgotten, until you mentioned it now, I'd forgotten about the cat next door. What a Mess was exactly the sort of dog that a cat would really hate. Like, clumsy, in your face, grubby. Cats would definitely hate What a Mess, yeah.
Well, moving on to your next choice now, and it's going from one not at all groomed animal to one immaculately groomed one. In fact, you probably had no choice in the matter.
Mon poney câlin est un merveilleux poney très tendre. Il a une longue queue et une belle crinière que l'on peigne et que l'on tresse. Mon poney câlin a aussi une couverture et un chapeau de cow-boy. Et en plus, il remue les oreilles, bouge la queue et cligne d'un œil. Mon poney câlin, un merveilleux poney très tendre.
Okay, that's probably a German advert there, because that's all I can find for My Pretty Pony. Joe, that's a bit of a familiar name, isn't it?
It is, it is. So, obviously, everyone knows My Little Pony. And every time I try to sort of explain My Pretty Pony to someone, which I find myself doing much more often than is healthy or normal, everybody always thinks that it must have been some, like, sort of fake knockoff version of My Little Pony that you could, like, get down the market. But no, nothing could be further from the truth. My Pretty Pony was the original kind of precursor to My Little Pony, and was just much better in every way, because My Little Pony, obviously, kind of weird pastel colours, very sort of sickly sugary coloured ponies that didn't really do anything other than have like long hair. You couldn't like move them, or I found My Little Pony really dull. But My Pretty Pony, which came before My Little Pony, it was much bigger. And although it was a somewhat stylized rendition of a pony, it did look a lot more like a real pony. And it was like a normal horse colour. It was a sort of a light, a tan colour with a sort of a blonde mane, like a palomino colour, I suppose. I think it's called for a real horse. I think they're called palominos. And it had like movable ears. And if you wiggled its ears, its tail would kind of swish backwards and forwards. And it had a little lever under its chin. So when you sort of scratched it under the chin and sort of manipulated this little chin lever, it would sort of open and close its eyes, I think. So I had this. I loved it. It came with various accessories like a brush and a saddle and a hat for some reason. And it had a really lovely long mane that you could do loads with. And I absolutely loved it. It was one of my favourite toys when I was little. But then when My Little Pony became popular, I was just horrified. I was like, these are horrible. They're horrible colours. You can do bugger all with them. But somehow I was the uncool one because I had My Pretty Pony and not these collectible pastel horrors. So I'm a bit resentful of My Little Pony. Even more resentful when I looked up My Pretty Pony for this podcast and found myself sort of directed to My Little Pony collector sites where everyone seems to be mad. But yeah, so I'm very resentful of My Little Pony, and My Pretty Pony was much better and inexplicably discontinued. God knows why.
Well, I've got to say, I only knew about it when I watched The Toys That Made Us about My Little Pony. It's basically the same, but they took a couple of tries to get it right. Here it is, My Massive Horse. The thing about it is, it is giant.
Yeah, it was huge, and yeah.
Is it solid plastic? Because it looks really, really heavy. You could use it in hand-to-hand combat. You could rob a bank with it.
It was massive, and it wasn't like, it was hollow, but it was a different kind of plastic. So it wasn't like My Little Pony, or that sort of slightly soft touch kind of vinyl-y plastic. Whereas this was just like, you know, rigid plastic. Like shiny, rigid, hard plastic, but kind of quite clattery kind of plastic. And it was much, much bigger. I mean, obviously, I was 5 when I had it, so it probably wasn't as big as I'm remembering it, because I was then very small. But it was much, much bigger than a My Little Pony. Much bigger. And yeah, it looked more like a real horse. Still slightly kind of a horse with a face a bit like a lady, but not as much as My Little Ponies. Much more horse-like. And I liked it for that reason, because I didn't really like fake-looking animals when I was a child. I liked a realistic rendition of an animal, me.
I don't quite understand the accessories, though, because they make it look like a sort of knock-off Buckaroo for Fun Pups. Although, if that kicked back when you put too many things on it, you will probably find yourself flung through a wall.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
But it's not treated anywhere like the progenitor, like the OG My Little Pony, I suppose. It's treated almost as like an afterthought. It's kind of like the Pete Best of My Little Pony.
Completely.
And even on the collector sites, they basically just say, yeah, we're just mentioning it reluctantly because sometimes they bundled My Little Ponies with it as kind of a mother and daughter horse. My Pretty Pony was there at the beginning. It's part of the creationist.
Absolutely. It was there at the beginning, and it was miles better. They didn't need to invent My Little Pony, because My Pretty Pony was brilliant. It was an excellent toy. And yeah, the accessories, it was a bit, the hat probably gave impression of being a bit buckaroo-ish. I don't really know why it had a hat. And it also had, like, you know, like various brushes and I think like a ribbon that you could tie in its tail and things. But yeah, I absolutely loved it. It was inexplicable to me that people preferred My Little Ponies when they could have had My Pretty Pony, which was massive, really solid, and just a much more robust and versatile toy all round, in my opinion.
Were you ever troubled by the inherent implication that there's non-pretty ponies in the range?
Yeah. Also, being the kind of kid that I was, I really, really loved animals. And I always sort of thought, well, what about the ugly ponies? Why aren't they getting equal attention? If I was a kid, I would always, you know, if there were some ponies in a field, I would have gone to the sort of one that had like one eye or something, because I'd have felt sorry for it. And that one would have been my favourite. So, yeah, the fact that prettiness was emphasised was, even as a child, I found slightly uncomfortable. There was no My Ugly Pony. It was like, My Pretty Pony, yeah, I've got some others, but they're not good looking enough, so we don't bother with those. We just leave those in the stables. Yeah, prettiness was very much emphasised rather than other horse-like qualities. I mean, it wasn't an active pony. It didn't jump, or its legs weren't movable, so it didn't. It did mostly stand there and you sort of brushed its hair, to be fair. So, I mean, prettiness was its main purpose, but you couldn't stage a Gymkhana with it.
But its total disappearance is weird when you think about, I mean, regardless of how either of us might actually feel about it, the present day My Little Pony phenomenon is astonishing, given that, yeah, you know, they've not even been able to refloat Masters of the Universe like that. They keep trying with things like Strawberry Shortcake, Mask, Micronauts. Nobody's tried it with Robot Anti-Terror Squad brackets Rats, but you know, there has to be a limit somewhere. But none of these things catch on in the same way, despite repeated attempts to revive them. And My Little Pony just seems to have endured regardless. Maybe it's that softer plastic, maybe it's so unbiodegradable.
Yeah, they never.
Yeah, we've got no option but to accept they're here to stay.
You've got to keep them now.
Rainbow Face, or whatever it's called, is just un-get rid of.
And I think anything where there are lots and lots of iterations of something, people obviously get obsessed with the collecting element. Because obviously with My Pretty Pony, there's just the one toy. It's not like there are loads of them. So I guess, like you say, My Little Pony is sort of a never-ending franchise, and people will always want to get like the new ones that come out. I suppose Care Bears similar? But I mean, I sort of remember playing with Care Bears when I was little, but I don't remember them. They've not hung around in quite the same way as My Little Pony, I don't think, have they? There aren't many Care Bear fandoms out there.
I actually don't want that in my Google search.
No, don't.
So I'm not going to check.
I'm not going to. I mean, there's enough disturbing things when you look up My Little Pony. I don't need to see that with Care Bears as well.
Okay, we're moving on to the next choice now, which I don't really know how to introduce this other than the fact that it's not really pretty at all.
In a remote period of American history, there was among the high hills, not far from Tarrytown, a drowsy little Dutch settlement, long known as Sleepy Hollow. There are some who say that this enchanted region was bewitched by a high German doctor. Others say that an Indian wizard held his powwows here. Certain it is that some power held a spell over the minds of the good people. The whole neighborhood abounds with local tales of haunted spots and twilight superstitions, and the most fearsome spirit of all, the Headless Horseman.
Okay, well, I don't blame you if you ended up skipping forward on that, because that is really, really creepy in a way it's not supposed to be. That is John Carradine introducing the legend of Sleepy Hollow, not the one you're thinking of, or the other one that you're thinking of. Joe, what's the story behind this?
So, there's more than one animated version out there, as you said, of the legend of Sleepy Hollow. There's a Disney one, which I think is sort of a similar vintage to the one I'm thinking of, but the one I'm thinking of is not that one. So when I was really, really tiny, and again, I think it was during the Christmas holidays, during the day in the Christmas holidays, so probably in a similar slot to What a Mess would have been on. But when I was very tiny, I remember watching this animated version of The Legend of Sleepy Hollow on the telly, and it was sort of mid-morning. It was so odd and sort of almost kind of dreamlike, and it had a really strong early 70s feel to it. So it was very kind of hand-drawn looking. It had that sort of slightly scratchy art style with the animation and a really like limited color palette. So it wasn't like your kind of bright psychedelic 70s, but more of the, you know, brown, murky, folky sort of 70s, a bit like the sort of illustrations you would get in like the Singing Together Schools radio book there. Like quite, you
yes,
know the kind of
exactly
thing I mean?
Like that. Gene Hunt would have found it too colourful.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very, very limited colour palette. And it sort of simultaneously really captivated, but also terrified me. Because it was, I mean, Legend of Sleepy Hollow is a creepy story anyway, but it was, the whole way it was presented was really creepy. And it was so American, but in a way, a sort of very particular way. So it wasn't like that kind of bright and lively American thing, like the Brady Bunch or whatever, that would have been on around the same time. But it was American in a way that made it almost feel otherworldly to me when I was really small. A bit like the narrator of, there used to be that like very sort of Technicolor wildlife program that was also on in the school holidays. I think it was called Survival, which had a very deep-voiced American narrator. And this kind of gave me the same sort of slightly portentous feeling when I was a child. And yeah, I've since found out that that was John Carradine. So it was very kind of, it felt very serious and very somber. And yeah, it's quite frightening. And I remember being like, Ichabod Crane in it is very sort of thin and skinny and quite creepy. And obviously there is the whole thing of the Headless Horseman, which is quite frightening when you're four or whatever. My mum remembers this. My mum remembers watching it with me, and I've discussed it with her. And she thinks there was a Rip Van Winkle one as well, which is obviously also Washington Irving story. But I don't remember that one. I only remember Sleepy Hollow. I've mentioned it to many people and they all sort of think I mean the Disney one, and no, I don't. My guess is that it would have been made maybe for, I don't know, but I would guess it was the sort of thing that might have been made for kind of like PBS in America. It had a very
yeah,
public service feel to it.
Yeah, an after school special, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, it has that sort of feel to it.
Well, I'm not surprised not many people remember it, because it isn't even listed on the Wikipedia page for the original Legend of Sleepy Hollow novel.
God.
Under adaptations, which is really exhaustive, it's not got that on there.
What if I have dreamt this?
No, it's absolutely real, because I did find it. And also, I noticed it was directed by Sam Weiss, who, my favourite fact about him, because he worked on a lot of things, like he directed Rocky and Bullwinkle, a lot of animated things, but he also worked on a 1954 film called The Fast and the Furious, which is not that one.
Not that
but
one.
But it's also about illegal car racing / paralegal activities.
How odd. How strange.
Apparently, the makers of the modern day The Fast and the Furious were completely unaware
That's
of it.
That's weird, isn't it?
It's one of those things things were. I don't think it's dropped off the radar. I'm not sure how much it was on the radar even at the time, because I would imagine when you saw it, it had probably been bought in bulk with a lot of other things.
Yeah, I would think
and
so.
I'm assuming it was on ITV, because the BBC quite often showed what was actually properly called The Adventures of Ichabod and Mr. Toad, which, you know, is trying to hide the sort of creepiness of Sleepy Hollow bit, I think, which was 1949. People forget that was narrated by Bing Crosby, actually.
Really?
It was. And I do remember in the early 80s, they tried to make a big thing about it. There was some new, I think, made for TV one called The All New Original Adventures of Ichabod Crane Rides Again or something. And the BBC made a really big deal of it being gone on a bank holiday. And it was just, all right, not that bothered. But the Disney one, really, the default view would be, oh, that really sanitizes novel. I don't think it does. I think even that is quite creepy.
I think it would be quite hard to make a sanitized version of the story because it is so... I mean, it couldn't be more creepy, really. And I also think that Disney back then were a bit better at being creepy than they are now as well. I think the other thing about it is that I guess if you're American, it's very much a classic story that you're really familiar with. Whereas for a kid in England, like, less so really, it's not really a famous thing that we would get. You know, we wouldn't have to read Washington Irving at school or anything like that. Whereas I think maybe American kids at one time probably did have to. So it also felt just sort of slightly alien in that it was being presented to me as a kind of a well-loved classic, but I had no idea what was going on and had never heard of it and just found it. It was like something that had just been broadcast in from another world and another time for me as a small child.
I know exactly what you mean, because that's exactly like, it would have been around the same time. One afternoon on ITV, they showed, it's a very famous sort of children's storybook in Germany, Max and Moritz, which is about two kind of miscreant boys who are always pulling pranks on people. And I won't spoil the really macabre surprise, but they come a cropper at the end in a really gruesome way because of one of their own pranks. And the way in which it happened is supposed to be sort of comic and, you know, ha ha ha, you didn't expect that, did you? But it's their just desserts. But that really disturbed me and haunted me for days. But obviously, you know, famous German storybook, we didn't have it over here. This version was made by Hallison Batchelor, the British animation studio, who did really creepy stuff at the best of times anyway. And narrated by Cyril Fletcher in his full-on odd-odes mode, who seemed to be taking glee and delight in what was happening. And it really bothered me. And I do remember, because you know the way the different ITV regions would show some things at different times around then. And I used to read the listings, you know, thinking, ooh, I wonder if they're getting Randall Hopkirk deceased in the Yorkshire region or whatever. But seeing Max and Moritz in Border or something, and sort of actually freezing when I saw it and thinking, yeah, good luck to the children of the Border region today. And obviously, you know, elsewhere, it's this hilarious, well-loved tale. But because I had no framework for it and no context, it really freaked me out.
I completely understand that. It's very German as well, a cautionary tale. There's the German, is it Struwwelpeter?
Yeah, again, that I did not understand as a child. You just see children walking around with copies of the book and thinking, what is that? Why have they translated it?
Yeah, because it's about someone who cuts children's hands off, basically. So, you know, that's meant to be fun. So very, very, very German. But also, the thing about things being on in different regions, you sort of know, if you see something that freaks you out as a child and then you see that it's on another day in a different region, you kind of know it still lives on out there, which makes it a bit more frightening. It's still alive somewhere. I would have been the same. I used to greatly enjoy regional TV listings when I was a child. Quite fascinated by Puffin's Place and things like that that we didn't get in the southeast.
Well, that does bring me on in a roundabout way to, I was going to say again about, you are right about the artwork in it. It's really sort of scratchy and weird. And it reminded me of, partly, there's a cartoon that used to float around the ITV regions where I think it was from probably the late 60s and it was Canadian, but it looked like it was from about 5,000 years ago called Max's 2,000-year-old mouse. It was made before he was even born. It was like a historical thing, but it had all that. A bit like the opening title of The High Chaparral.
Oh, yeah.
Which are quite odd when you look back to them. But also, like, do you remember sometimes in newsagents you get, and it would cost about 20 pence and be the size of about a lift door, and it'd be like Wild West Scenorama or something. Where it's, you know,
oh, yeah, yeah.
You weren't sure what to do with it, but you supposedly slotted all things together to make, you know, a Wild West street saloon thing. But it had that kind of artwork.
Yeah,
but it was moving on screen in this.
That that was a very 70s thing, wasn't it? A lot of people who are sort of into kind of folk horror and hauntology and kind of Haunted Generation stuff are very familiar with that style of artwork because it was on a lot of things. And like I say, it was the booklets that you used to get for singing together at school. And a lot of kind of schools, on a previous episode of this podcast, I talked about SRA reading cards. The artwork on those was a bit like that as well. Limited colour palette. Quite scratchy and hand done in a way that you kind of don't really see anymore. I was quite fascinated by it.
Well, I would argue that people always try to come out with bizarre reasons and theories behind why these things happened, or, you know, why Bagpuss looked so odd or whatever. With this artwork, it was probably just some artist thought, what else have we got to do this morning? School's radio booklet. There you go. Sent it, you know, minimal effort, minimal colouring in, which I would not blame them for. There was no grand plan.
No, no grand
plan. Indoctrinate a generation of children into Wiccan pursuits, whatever.
No, absolutely not. And also, like, just cheap as well. The more limited your colour palette, the cheaper it is to print. So,
yes.
It's like, for something that's, you know, made for schools, it's always going to be done on a budget, isn't it? So, I mean, and if indeed the Sleepy Hollow cartoon that I'm thinking of was sort of made for public broadcast in America, I'm guessing that the same applied. Because they would have been on a really tight budget. I mean, God knows how they afforded John Carradine. But as I say, I think also because, you know, when you're a kid and things are sort of on during the holidays and you just kind of catch things by accident, and it's the things that you catch by accident that are one-offs that kind of tend to stay with you because you never see them again and you've never seen them before. And it's sort of you're kind of caught in that moment. And for me, Legend of Sleepy Hollow was one of those moments. So it's really stayed with me.
Well, I can tell you something that is on the Wikipedia page for the novel, which I was utterly surprised by. It was a 1980 kind of high-profile American TV movie of it, live action. I'm going to give you three guesses to who played Ichabod Crane.
Right, so 1980... I might have to do 20 questions here. Is it someone who is incredibly miscast?
No, because I would honestly say they look the most Ichabod Crane it's possible for an actor of that generation.
Oh, really? You're going to have to tell me then.
Jeff Goldblum.
Of course. That's brilliant casting. That's excellent casting.
I actually want to watch it now.
I do too. I definitely do. Because, I mean, I quite like Tim Burton's Sleepy Hollow, but Ichabod Crane does not look like Johnny Depp. I like Tim Burton's films, but just casting Johnny Depp as everyone doesn't work. You can't always have Johnny Depp. So the film, for that reason, doesn't... I mean, I love the film, but it doesn't work as a Sleepy Hollow adaptation for me. But Jeff Goldblum is perfect casting for Ichabod Crane. I can't believe I haven't seen this. I'm going to have to look for it.
Okay, well, I can think of something that you won't be looking up on YouTube after recording this, which is your next choice, which, to be honest with you, I'm not looking... I'm not even looking forward to watching this to insert a clip, but here's one.
I am the justice, dear.
Stop thief! Stop thief!
This is the story of a little chimney sweep named Tom and his amazing adventures on land and, believe it or not, underwater.
What exactly are you trying to do?
Can't you see? Swim!
Gill!
The Water Babies is the first film version of a story which has charmed millions of children, and grown-ups too, for many generations.
Hello, Tom.
It's the first time anyone's got my name right. How did you know?
Water babies just do, the way you know our names.
You're saying I'm a water baby? Stone me!
Come enjoy the delightful company of all the wonderful characters inspired by this beloved classic in a movie filled with fun and magic and sensational new songs.
When you're thinking hard
and you think you want lots,
got to try a little harder.
Up here, the stars of the Water Babies are James Mason, Bernard Cribbins, Billy Whitelaw, Joan Greenwood, David Tomlinson, Tommy Pender, Samantha Gates, Paul Luty, and of course the faithful Toby.
No, but what a disgusting, filthy disgrace to humanity you are.
Okay, I'm really not happy I had to watch any of that again. That was The Water Babies, and we'll come back to how I saw that later. But Joe, what was it? How did you first see it?
I first saw this at someone's birthday party when I was a child.
I knew it.
this was in the days when, sort of fairly early days of video recorders, when sometimes at someone's party you would have a sort of video party where you would all kind of sit on the floor of their parents' living room and watch a rented video. And I went to someone's house and we watched The Water Babies. And again, 70s, very 70s. It's a film adaptation of the novel, the Victorian novel. It's directed by Lionel Jeffries, and it's part live action and part animated. And it's the sort of underwater section of the story that's animated, that's a cartoon. And that's all sort of quite jolly. It's a musical, it's got songs. There's, for some reason, a very camp seahorse that's voiced by Melvin Hayes. And there's a Glaswegian lobster.
Melvin Hayes doing camp voice, really?
Surprise.
He doesn't turn up in the books.
Never typecast, Melvin Hayes, never typecast. Yeah, and a Glaswegian lobster character. And I don't really remember what sort of happened in the animated bits, because that was completely overshadowed by the live action sequences that were terrifying and weird and really gritty and so out of step with the animation that it was almost like watching two completely different films. And the opening of it, which I have watched on YouTube recently and I still find really creepy and weird, it begins with Tom, who is the sort of the child chimney sweep character, making his way through like a marketplace. And you'd think that would, you know, you would imagine in a children's film that would be like a scene from Oliver or something where there's like, you know, jolly ruddy cheeked people selling flowers and things like that. But no, it's not like that at all. It's a really sort of nightmarish, seedy, muddy, kind of sweaty place full of sort of just destitution and filth. There's a bit where there's like a sort of a really a clearly kind of desperate beggar woman who's kind of crying out for money from passers-by while she's kind of breastfeeding a scrawny baby. And there's a gurner who is really pulling terrifying faces. And there's a, like a butcher with a tray of pig's heads and dead rabbits. And oh, there's a bare knuckle fight as well, which is like actually, I mean, it's not like a comedy bare knuckle fight. It's genuinely like really violent and horrible. And there's sort of a horrible fortune teller played by Billy Whitelaw. She keeps appearing in different guises in the film, one of whom is a really creepy sort of old crone. And then we meet Tom's master, Mr. Grimes, who's played by James Mason, who's very good at playing a villain, and he is a very sort of a very kind of creepy whispery voice. Also, Bernard Cribbins is in this playing a baddie, which is very, very unusual. I don't think I've ever seen Bernard Cribbins be evil in anything, but he plays Grimes's kind of sidekick. And obviously they're very horrible to Tom. Well, I mean, they're making him climb up chimneys, so obviously they're going to be horrible to him. They sort of live in really kind of squalid conditions, and it's just the whole thing is really just makes you want to have a bath after you've watched it. It was a really odd way of presenting that to children. I mean, it's probably a lot more in keeping with the original book than any other adaptation, I would say, because the original book is really dark. And obviously the life of a child chimney sweep in Victorian times was absolutely horrific. So it's probably quite realistic, except because it was made in the 70s. Tom has got like awful 70s hair and looks like a Victorian Tucker Jenkins. It's a very odd film. Like the animated bits are fine, just kind of a jolly cartoon. But the top and tailing is astonishing. Astonishingly horrible.
Well, there were quite a few animated or semi-animated children's films like this around this time. Things like The Secret of Nim and so on. Where it was like not even an adult's idea of what children liked. It was what adults had decided children must be made to like this. Yeah. And, you know, they usually were just traumatised by it. I mean, the one that I always come back to was this was... There is a name I'm going to mention in a second, and I will point out this was weird and creepy even before we knew certain things. But there's a film from around the time called, I think it's A Little Convict. It's a grim tale of hardship in recent history, etc., etc. But there's a bit where an ill elderly man remembers a song from his childhood, and it cuts to, on film, dressed apparently as some kind of chimney sweep stroke Undertaker hybrid, Rolf Harris singing that Whiskey on a Sunday song, which is really creepy anyway.
Hell.
And I remember, because I think I was a little bit older when I saw that, and I thought, why does anyone think kids want to see that? But The Water Babies, I was taken to see in the cinema when it came out, and I distinctly remember this, because it opens with a sort of caption slide of that same sort of artwork we're just talking about. Of Tom by a chimney looking like, you know, the picture's actually decaying in real time in the 4 or 5 seconds it's on screen, with some kind of caption in ye olde writing about the terrible tale of a young sweep beaten by society or whatever. And I remember basically, you know, thinking, yeah, this isn't going to be Hong Kong Phoebe, is it? Like, find the whole experience really grim and draining and traumatising. Not understanding why all the other children in the cinema were thinking, hi, 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 cockalorum, for about 5 minutes after the song had finished. I'm just thinking, why did I see that? These are kind of like, the world is horrible, not even get used to it, we are forcing you to accept it. And it's not that surprising me, because how much do you know about Charles Kingsley who wrote it?
I don't know much about Charles Kingsley himself.
I've been able to find out he was a priest.
Oh, right.
And he seems to be very keen on white people unless they were Irish. Now, that's not extrapolation.
Right.
That is taken for direct quotes from him.
Right. Nice. what a charmer.
But also, like you say, it was adapted and directed by Lionel Jeffries, who was best known for his long association with things like Hammer films and British crime dramas and so on. Not really with children's films. They did one other children's film, which I think was the year before, which was Wombling Free, which I'm going to say, again, is quite fucking grim for a children's film. So all of that together, I mean, the only mitigating thing is the bizarre fact that James Mason was Belinda Carlisle's father-in-law.
Really weird, yeah, really weird.
So had it been a couple of years later, she might have gone to the premiere of it.
It reminds me a bit of when I was a child, there seemed to be a lot of things like that. And I've obviously talked about The December Rose on this podcast before, and Leon Garfield, and lots of children's stories about Victorian orphans suffering horribly. The opening bits of this film are very much of that ilk. And the book is so weird as well. It's so odd. It's quite a difficult read. It's because it's just so peculiar. In the book, it's kind of obvious that the whole idea of Tom the Chimney Sweep going into the water and then coming out and being kind of rescued, it's the whole idea of a sort of a cleansing thing. And Kingsley obviously thinks that this, you know, the poverty of is horrific and people are living in squalor.
Isn't it partly based on what I understand is a myth perpetrated at the time? The Victorian mothers were throwing babies they couldn't afford into the water so they could feed the rest of them.
Yeah, I think there's something, I think there is an element of that to it. Yeah.
It's the sort of thing the poor do.
Yeah, also giving like their children to chimney sweeps to work, in, you know, selling your child to a chimney sweep. And the whole thing of Tom being kind of very grubby and then obviously being washed clean of all the soot when he's in the water and things is all very quite obvious symbolism. And as I say, it's because it's so out of kilter with the very jolly animation as well, it's really peculiar. But the thing is, although I watched this and thought, like, what this is horrific, I then remember it was on the telly not long afterwards, and I taped it off the telly and kept it and watched it about 50 times. So obviously I was a glutton for punishment, and that's why I remember it so clearly, because I've seen it about 1,000 times. But even when I went back on YouTube and looked at the opening recently, I thought, like, God, I'm still a bit frightened. It seems more shocking now than it did then, funnily enough. Maybe you just accept things as a child in a way that you don't when you're an adult. I don't know if that's a good thing or not. But yeah.
Well, I think what doesn't help it as well in retrospect is that, you know, there is a big cast of British character actors, of people like Lance Percival's in it, David Jason, John Pertwee. Yeah. But the two leads in it, Tommy Pender and Samantha Gates, were the sort of child actors where usually the case is either they stopped getting work when they became an adult because they were good at playing kids but not really playing adults, or they decided they want to do something else.
Yeah.
That kind of gives these things a weirder resonance, though. Because it's like they only existed for that period of time and what happens to them after that. I mean, they both seem to be quite prominent at the time, because Tommy Pender was always small boy in things like When the Boat Comes In and Four Idle Hands, but he was one of the leads in Graham's Gang, which obviously being completely forgotten now, but that was, you know, when you got those kind of hard as nails children's comedy dramas in the late 70s, and that was the big one then. Well, I say the Paper Lads was the big one. I will actually fight people like the Paper Lads with the Fort Graham's Gang over that. But Samantha Gates is on the cover of Houses the Holy by Led Zeppelin.
What? No.
And she did have a few roles as an adult, including she was in Dennis Potter's Black Eyes.
Really?
But again, she just seems to have gone on to do something else. It's like, it makes these things seem even more like they belong to the past.
Yeah, very much so. I don't remember seeing her in anything else ever. And I sort of vaguely remember seeing him in things, or sort of knowing, but only after I'd seen him in The Water Babies, I think. I didn't recognise him when I saw the film, so. And yeah, like you say, you do sort of get the feeling as if they just sort of cease to exist after, which in itself is weird. And I'm also unsettled that she was in Black Eyes as well, because that was such a weird, creepy, sort of unpleasant and very, very adult drama as well.
Okay, well, moving on to your next choice now, which is a slightly more palatable slice of modern-day Victoriana.
But the one nearest to Mr. Benn had just one young man. So he asked the young man what was happening. It's a balloon race, said the young man. We're all going to race to the next town.
I would love to win, but it's very difficult against a cheat. Who cheats? Asked Mr. Benn. Wicked Baron Bartram. The man with a tall hat in the next balloon.
Okay, little bit from the balloon race episode of Mr. Benn there, because there's nothing else I could really use as a clip for this. The Magnificent Race. Joe, sounds like you had a lot of fun with this.
I had so much fun with it. It was by far my favourite board game when I was a child. And it was the one that I would always kind of choose to, on the last day of term when we were allowed to bring in games at primary school, I would always take the Magnificent Race because nobody else had it. And it was a board game sort of based around the concept of, I suppose, maybe more 1920s than Victorian, I would say, because it's based around the concept of a kind of round the world car rally. So a bit like the film The Great Race, which was always on bank holiday afternoons on the telly if there wasn't a James Bond film.
Only if Genevieve wasn't on, which is more or less the same film.
similar, yeah. It was a whole genre at the time.
The vintage car cinema.
Travelling wacky trips around the world in vintage cars was a whole thing. And in fact, my mum always used to get the names the wrong way around. So she would always, the Magnificent Race board game, my mum would always call it The Great Race and vice versa. Or she'd say, well, the Magnificent Race is on the telly. No, mum, it's the other one. I remember the game having, it was quite complex. It had quite a few different elements to it. You had to move around the board to sort of different world cities. There was money involved because I think you got winnings for your races. And there was also a sort of a pegboard thing that you used to keep score, which was a bit like a cribbage scoring board. And in order to score, you have to sort of win races. And that entailed everyone putting these coloured plastic ball things, like little coloured plastic marbles, into a kind of like a spinner, like a roulette style spinner. And if your colour marble ended up in the little kind of winner's slot, there's a little sort of dimple in it, if your marble settled in that when the spinner came to a stop, then you won the race. But there was a twist, which was there was a lone black marble which represented the villain of the game, who nobody could play. You couldn't play as him. And he was Dastardly Dan. Now, obviously, that sounds a lot like Dick Dastardly.
And also, Dan isn't a very dastardly name.
No, it happens to begin with D, doesn't it? It's not like, they've not thought it through. But I think the game was nothing like Wacky Races. It was much more like The Great Race, because it involved like travel to like glamorous cities. And it all just seemed really exciting to me. Like sort of glamorous travel. Glamorous kind of travel in the 20s and 30s was always one of my favourite things as a child, and still is. So things like Death on the Nile and Murder on the Orient Express and The Great Race and things like that, people kind of travelling to far-flung places in great luxury and vintage cars, it always seemed like incredibly glamorous. And also it had very nice kind of 70s interpretations of Art Deco graphics on the box and things, and it all just felt quite sort of lavish and exciting. Yeah, I absolutely loved it. And my whole family, it was one of the only board games that I remember playing as a family when I was a child, because like when I got a bit older, we used to play like Trivial Pursuit and Pictionary and things like that, but we never played Monopoly as a family or anything like that, or Cluedo, probably because my parents quite rightly found them incredibly tiresome. But the whole family was on board with a game of Magnificent Race. So I remember it very fondly, but nobody else does.
Well, it really does have that aesthetic of sort of, you know, when you find like an early 70s reprint of a PG Woodhouse collection in the charity shop, and it has got that look where, you know, yeah, this is recognisably the 20s to me, but it does not look like the proper 20s.
No, absolutely.
The sort of colours they wouldn't have used. So it's got that lovely kind of, because apparently from 1975, that lovely 70s version of the 20s feel to it. It's almost like postmodern in a sense.
Yeah, it's a bit like when you see a film, like a good example is the adaptation of Far From the Madding Crowd that has Terence Stamp in it. I think it's Terence Stamp and Julie Christie in it. It's obviously Victorian, but everyone kind of looks very 1960s somehow. We've got like the women's makeup is all like a kind of a 60s take on Victoriana, and the hair is like not like anyone would have had that. Like, no one would have had that hair in the 1800s and things. So it's kind of everyone's in period costume, but it still really, really looks like the 60s. This is that, but the 20s. Like you say, exactly like if you find a 70s version of a P.G. Woodhouse novel. It's got that sort of feel to it. Also, if you find a 70s imprint of an Enid Blyton book or something, they'll be kind of, the kids will be sort of drawn in the kind of clothes they would have worn in the 1940s, but there's still something really 70s about it. It's very much like that in The Magnificent Race.
I'm still very intrigued, though, by this sort of Dick Dastardly, Dastardly Dan disparity, because it would have been around the same time. I'm not saying the two were in any way connected at all, but are you aware of Scooby's All-Star Laugh Olympics?
I am aware. It was the sort of thing that I would have spurned as a child, but I am aware of it, yeah.
Well, for anyone who is thinking, what, that is just some words, it was a Hanna-Barbera series, the tie-in with the 1976 Olympics. And I think we got it in about 78. I think it was shown as part of Swap Shop. It was basically all the Hanna-Barbera characters came together, sort of Marvel Secret Wars style, yeah, to fight each other in the Olympics. But there was a problem where, I mean, they had all kinds of, you know, characters like Jabberjaw, you know, and obscure characters like that were in it. But for some reason, they could not use Dick Dastardly and Muttley. So it replaced them with the Dread Baron, who was more or less the same as Dick Dastardly, and Mumbly, who was basically a blue Muttley, who then later, bizarrely, had his own series where he was basically like a parody of Columbo.
How
Mumbly got from there to there was never explained. But was there some kind of weird Dick Dastardly rights issue in the 70s?
Who knows?
This was somehow caught up in.
The word dastardly as well is quite, it's not a commonly used word, is it? It's
no.
It's a word very much of a time and of a genre. So it seems difficult to imagine that it was a coincidence, but I kind of feel that it maybe was. Because, like I say, it doesn't really have anything in common with Wacky Races at all. It's just not like that. It's got a much more kind of grown-up feel to it, with sort of glamorous grown-up feel to it, The Magnificent Race. So I really don't know. Also, I still don't know whether the lone black marble that represented Dastardly Dan was weighted in some way, because he seemed to win more often than you would expect.
Well, he was dastardly. He probably weighted it himself, yeah, and broke into the factory.
I imagine that was his equivalent of getting a box marked tax and throwing them in front of the other cars.
Well, I couldn't actually find this online to check, but I have to know, was there a visual representation of Dastardly Dan, or was it just a name?
I don't think there was. I don't remember seeing. I can't picture Dastardly Dan. I think if there was, he was probably in a top hat, I would say. I'm guessing top hat and moustache, obviously waxed moustache, because all villains have to have like that kind of moustache in that time. So I'm guessing, I imagine he would maybe perhaps look a bit like a sort of a very villainous Terry Thomas, but I don't remember if he was depicted visually, and I don't think he was. I might have to do some research on this. I wonder if it's still in my mum's loft somewhere. Probably not, but yeah. If ever a game was made to be adapted into a film, it would be The Magnificent Race, absolutely, because it would be really exciting, really glamorous, loads of amazing locations. It would be like, oh, it'd be brilliant, but I'd like to make it happen if anyone actually remembers the game, but nobody does.
Well, moving on to your next choice now, which is another franchise that I think even if somebody did want to make films of them now, they will probably not be allowed to.
But it was the first for his two sons, Hal and Roger. And yet, they were not quite new to the animal game. Hal had hunted mountain lions in Colorado and Mexico, and both he and his younger brother had tended the collections in their father's Long Island supply zoo, where animals brought back from exploration trips were kept until they were bought by zoos, circuses, or museums. "Nobody knows," said John Hunt cautiously, "how many animals there are in the Amazon Valley, because so much of the country has not yet been explored. We're going to explore a new part of it on this trip, if all goes well. The Pastaza River."
Okay, little clip there with the talking book of Amazon Adventure by Will Price. Joe, that's a name that's burnt into my memory, even though I'm not sure I ever actually read any of his books. So fill us in, please.
Well, the name probably would be burnt into your memory because there were so many of these books. There were just hundreds and hundreds of them. Willard Price's books, there were lots of them, and they were about two brothers called Hal and Roger, who were sort of teenagers, I think. And they accompany their father on trips to capture wild animals for sort of zoos and things like that. That probably already indicates that these were books very much of their time. And even when I read them, so I was probably about 9 when I read them, even then I found them a bit problematic. So the plots mostly featured Hal and Roger mostly going to sort of developing countries, stealing animals and like patronising the local people. I mean, they were really like rip-roaring adventures, but they had there was something quite colonial about them. So they were really full of like loads of action, really gory. One of them was set in Kenya during the Mau Mau uprising, which doesn't really feel like something that, like, for a children's book, but you know,
no.
And I remember being quite frightened of that one. And there's another one which I mean, they're all called things like Gorilla Adventure or Amazon Adventure or African Adventure or Undersea Adventure and things like that. They've all got adventure in the title. And there's one which is one of the diving based ones where someone gets their foot trapped in a giant clam and their oxygen's running out. And I think they realises that he might have...
Rock Lobster by the B-52s.
Yeah, he sort of realises that his oxygen is running out and that he might have to hack his foot off if he's got any chance of surviving and things like that. And people were always getting, like, bitten by cobras and dying after stepping on, like, a poisonous stonefish at the Barrier Reef or something like that. I mean, I don't know who was letting these two kids... Because they're only teenagers, Hal and Roger, I think, like youngish teenagers. Who is letting them do this stuff? Why are they being allowed to do these things with their dad? Yeah, it's all very... And there's usually a villain in each one. And yeah, they're very un-eco-friendly, very bad on the animal cruelty front, and also really racist. So, I mean, they're probably not going to be hitting the shelves of Waterstones again anytime soon, I don't think. But much as they were incredibly problematic, I also found them incredibly gripping and read absolutely hundreds of them. There was also not many girls read them, actually. I don't know any other girls that read them. They were really marketed to boys, but I really, really, really like them. I think they were probably also meant for kids a bit older than me when I read them, because I was about 9. I think they were probably more of aimed at the kind of 12 upwards, maybe, age range. I mean, yeah, of their time.
Well, I will be a little bit fair to Willard Price here, because I did do a bit of reading up on this, and it seems to have been a bit sort of cake and eat it, where characters will do long speeches about, you know, the colonies won't last forever, these fellows are independent and clever, and, you know, they'll set up on their own new watch and then say, right, now we're off to confront the cannibals.
So exactly.
Using the stereotypes at the same time as rejecting them. But now he will probably be the third person on the sofa on GB News. Sort of representing both viewpoints at once. But, you know, it leaves a little bit to be desired from modern perspective, but at least there was some attempt there to address issues. But, yeah, a lot of it is a little bit... isn't mitigated by that.
No, not really. It's not like the native population of all the countries they visit is depicted in a negative light at all. They're not. But there is a sort of, even when they're trying to be, like you say, even when they're trying to address the issues, they're still sort of, it's done in a way that's quite patronising. These plucky black fellows will soon be setting up on their own and things like that. They're almost as good at this as we are. It's like, that's the sort of, it's got that sort of vibe to it. The Mau Mau Uprising one as well, obviously, presumably not very pro-Kenyan independence in that one, because the Mau Mau are depicted as absolute monstrous savages in that one. There's a particular bit where there's a sort of description of them, member of the Mau Mau wearing a leopard skull as a mask sort of thing, and it's all very scary, and that one I do remember finding really dark. So yeah, I mean I was 9, so unsurprisingly it was clearly unsuitable. But also the fact that just like going to capture wild animals for sort of zoos and research is like not really, and it's not great, is it, like going to capture a gorilla or something. It's a bit much, isn't it?
I imagine much the same happened in Lion Adventure.
Yeah.
I like the sound of Volcano Adventure.
I don't remember that one, but I imagine it would have been great.
My main memory of them turns out to be slightly wrong in that I always record them as being sort of books out of time, where, you know, anywhere you saw a big block of books for children, whether it was the library or, you know, on the table at a school fair or just on the shelf round at someone from school's house.
Yeah.
Where there'd be one book at the end that looked just imperceptible. Older than the others. And you think, why did that get there? My memory is that was always a Willard Price one, but apparently the series went right through from 1949 to 1980, and at no point, I'm astonished by this, at no point did Hal and Roger go into space.
No.
Not in the 50s, no. Not in the 70s, and they stayed resolutely, not just on Earth, but in one particular region of the Earth as well.
Yeah, I don't think they could have gone to space because there would have been no opportunity to ensnare an animal.
Or to patronise other life forms.
Yeah, to patronise some aliens, yeah. There was always the sort of wildlife element to it. I don't remember the Volcano Adventure one, but there would have been some sort of animal snatching involved. I imagine probably in that one someone would have come to a horrific end with some molten lava or something like that, I would have thought, because they normally did. But I didn't know that they were still making them in 1980. I mean, when the ones that I read, you could always get a Willard Price at a jumble sale, and occasionally we would sort of get given a box of a few old books from, you know, a relative or something who was getting rid of their kids' books, and they go, oh, you know, does Joe want these? And I go through them. So I had a mixture of sort of modern reprints, which were, you know, had a sort of 80s look to them. But then I also had some really old ones that kind of smelt a bit weird and had mildly more racist illustrations. So I had a mixture of them. So you would get a bit like now, if my kind of Agatha Christie collection was similar in that I had some really old ones that were my nan's and smelt of cigarettes and had like kind of, you know, 1950s covers. But then I had like kind of modern ones that I'd bought new. So Willard Price's books were a bit like that. You'd have an odd, if you had a set of Willard Price's, you would have ones spanning about 40 years probably, because they were in print for a long time. I'm amazed that the last one was as late as 1980 actually.
Well, it also, I felt quite sorry for the whole range. I mean, I cannot honestly remember whether I read one as a child or not. I must have done, because they were everywhere. But looking back now, there are so many other sort of similar book series for children or teenagers that in some respects have not aged well, but people have sort of rehabilitated them on an artistic level. So I mean, particularly you look at, I suppose, Choose Your Own Adventure, which there's a lot of dubious stuff in there now, and yeah, they're from the 80s, but they're being really sort of reassessed now. Richard Allen's books, you know, Skinhead and all them, the Judy Blume Shockers, you know, they seem to be kind of really accepted now with classic children's literature. Poor old Hal and Roger are just out there, probably still on some, they're probably stranded on a remote island trying to send smoke signals saying, hello, we're still here.
Probably, yeah.
And I want them to be rediscovered. But
they remind me, yeah, it's inexplicable that Enid Blyton is still really, really popular. And we just sort of, I mean, you know, now and again, there'll be a bit of a debate about them being censored or altered and things like that, which fair enough. I think the thing is, if you tried to update Willard Price for a modern audience, there would not really be anything left. You'd have a very short book if you took out everything that was problematic, probably.
No, but it's the sort of thing where they do deluxe reprints of them aimed at an adult audience with somebody like, I don't know, Mark Gatiss writing an introduction, you know, saying, yeah, a lot isn't right about them, but they're still ripping stories.
Yeah, because I bet you can still get like nice grown-up editions of Biggles and things like that, for example, which are also massively racist and wrong in a lot of ways. So I don't see why poor old Price doesn't get a look in. I think I started reading them when, because like I say, they were also very much, as I said, aimed more at boys. I don't really know any other girls that read them. And I think I started reading them because my sort of friend at the time, who lived a, sort of a few doors down from me, was exactly the same age as me, my friend Ben, he had some, and we used to lend each other books all the time because we were both really keen readers. And he lent me one of them, and then I sort of started reading more and more of them, and we sort of both had them and used to kind of swap them and stuff. So that's how I started reading them. But again, like maybe partly because they were aimed at boys, and boys, I think, men read less fiction than women, certainly statistically, I think. So maybe, yeah, I don't know why they're not remembered quite as, apart from the fact that they're really offensive, I don't know why they're not remembered more fondly by more people, because like I say, a lot of people sort of don't, or a lot of people seem to remember them but never read any, like you, which is weird. They were quite formulaic. I mean, if you'd read one, you'd really read them all, to be honest. So yeah.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, I was surprised, actually astonished really, that exact same formula was still going in new books in the late 70s, but it did make me think about, around that time, I had a Tarzan annual, not related to the Ron Eli TV series, not related to the Filmation cartoon, just Tarzan, the brand, where it was really full of sort of, you know, they thought not to have anything offensive in it, but you know, the front cover was him wrestling with a massive snake that was about to bite him in the face. So it was all that sort of stuff. Although there was one story in it where he encountered the UFO in the jungle and fought some robots. But you know, there was no Nakima or Cheetah or even Jane. It was classic Tarzan presented, because it was an annual, so it was for very young children. So that obviously was still an imperative around then. We must educate them about the golden age of adventuring.
It must have been, because I sort of just remember, and I've never really thought about this until you mentioned it now, when I was a child, Tarzan was just sort of a character that everyone knew and had heard of and had an image of in their head, like Dracula or Frankenstein's monster or whatever. Everyone knew Tarzan. I mean, most people that knew Tarzan had probably never read the book or anything like that, and had probably, you know, maybe seen an old black and white Tarzan with Johnny Weissmuller wearing a loincloth. And then there would be sort of, you know, like there was obviously the film Greystoke came out, which is a terrible film, and so on, and like you say, TV things. But you could easily have a Tarzan annual without ever actually having seen anything or read anything else Tarzan related, but still know exactly what the setup was. But I think that whole adventuring thing is quite, if you look in, I was in a secondhand bookshop a few months ago, Leakey's Books in Inverness. If you're in Inverness, it's great, you should go in there. They had a whole section of children's books, and there were a are lots and lots of old kind of books in there from like the 1930s, which were sort of very much of an adventuring theme. The boys' ones are like always involve some sort of colonial goings on. They're always abroad. On the cover, they're normally like wrestling with someone in a grass skirt who's holding a big spear, you know, properly really offensive covers. And then the girls' ones are normally not set abroad. They're normally set at the UK and are much more kind of hearty and sort of outward bound. So pictures of girls like hiking up a mountain or something like that. Very sort of girl guide-ish. We didn't get to do as much adventuring, really. Maybe that's why I like Willard Price. There were very few adventuring-based girl-led novels in those days. So, yeah, I had to go with Willard.
Well, I'm wondering how Hal and Roger would have fared against your last choice, where I can't think of anything to use as a clip for this. So whatever I've used, just listen to it. Okay, no idea what I've used there, as I say. So, Joe, what was Snapper Crocodiles? And was there ever Snapper Crocodile Adventure?
There must have been an alligator adventure or a crocodile adventure, I'm sure. Or like a swamp adventure. There must have been one. But yeah, these were not related. So when I was a kid, it's so hard to explain because it's such a sort of generic, non-branded thing. But when I was a kid, you could always buy in, you would normally get them in sort of seaside gift shops or, and things like that, or kind of in the sort of pocket money section of a cheap shop. You could buy these like cheap sort of metal crocodiles, which came in a wide range of colours and patterns. And all they did was make a sort of a really pleasing kind of snappy, clicky sort of noise when you opened and shut its mouth. So it had a sort of a spring-loaded mouth, like a bit like a sort of a clothes peg, I suppose, similar sort of. But it made a really lovely clicking noise, a bit like the clicker things. If anyone's ever had a clicker trainer for a dog, where the clicking noise alerts them that you're about to tell them to do something, made a noise a bit like that. And you would sort of get them, maybe you might get one in your Christmas stocking or something like that. Just, you know, a cheap tap, basically. But I particularly remember them because one day when I was about 6 or 7, there was some kind of direct marketing campaign where every single household on the housing estate where we lived got one of these crocodiles through the letterbox, along with like an advertising leaflet about like insurance or mortgages or something like that, something really boring like that. I don't know why the crocodile was connected. But consequently, every single child within, you know, a sort of 2 mile radius had got one of these snapping crocodiles through the letterbox. So the next day, every single child brought one to school. And every single child was like running around with the playground with them at playtime, clicking them and sort of snapping them at each other and clipping them onto each other's ears and things like that, and sort of comparing who had which colours and swapping them because they all came in a kind of different alligator livery. And our poor teachers were just immediately just driven to distraction by the incessant snapping sound and kind of constant arguments about whose crocodile was whose and so on. And as such, we were instantly banned from ever bringing them into school again. Like, so it was the shortest lived cheap craze ever to hit my school, because, like, you know, literally one day it was like, right, no more crocodiles, don't bring them in ever again. It's too much.
Well, I've got two immediate questions about that, which is, one, did anyone dare to bring one in after that?
I remember someone having one and we're going, oh, you're not allowed to bring them in, you're allowed to bring them in. And then but they just couldn't resist making the noise because they were so pleasingly, it's almost like, I suppose it's almost like kids having like a fidget spinner or something, you know, they're really hard to resist making them do the little snappy thing. And this kid sort of sat there and he had it like hidden in his pencil case and he just couldn't resist making it do the snapping noise. And our teacher was like, was that a crocodile? Like, heard it across the classroom and immediately confiscated it. I think you can still buy them. I think you can. I think you can still buy them online as kind of gifts that you would put in like a children's party bag kind of thing. That was the other sort of place where you might have got one, in a party bag, in the sort of shops that used to sell like little string bags of cheap marbles, and a gift shop at a zoo or something like that. The same sort of places where you would be able to buy those like jointed plastic snakes that kind of wiggled around. That sort of retail outlet would stock a snapping crocodile. But yes, obviously, if you were really lucky, you just got one through your letterbox.
Well, that's my next question, which is, who was distributing them and why?
I don't know. It must have been something. I think it was something really boring, because I sort of remember saying, like, well, like, Mum's saying, oh, look, do you want this crocodile? And I'd be like, well, where's this come from? And she said, oh, it came with an advert for something. But it must have been something really boring, and I've remembered. It wasn't like a child-friendly thing. And I don't really know what the crocodile connection must have been.
Lawyers or insurance, sort of the people who work there, probably don't want to be aligning themselves to crocodiles, given their usual public image.
No, you wouldn't think so. I can't really think of any kind of company that would have been pro-crocodile.
Was it Willard Price?
Maybe, yeah, Willard Price Insurance Limited. It was definitely something really boring. And I think it must have just been like a sort of a direct marketing gimmick, where it was sort of in the envelope with a letter or an advert or something. But I just remember every single person having one. And of course, when they came through the door, we didn't know that everyone had got one. So it was like, everyone was like, oh, this is brilliant, this thing I got through the letterbox. So everyone took it to school and was then amazed to see that everyone else had one. And everyone, it was like, oh, you got one as well. You got one. Oh, you've got a red one. Oh, like, and it was all really, oh, it was one of the most exciting school days ever. But it's curtailed immediately by an instant crocodile ban.
Well, I have mixed feelings about things that were banned in school, because on the one hand, as the child of two teachers, I am aware of the misery and the mayhem that crazes wrought.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But on the other hand, I do remember ridiculous things. Like, one of my favourite examples, I think I was in junior school, but there was some kind of ice lolly. I don't know if it was a Superman ice lolly, it was just generic DC characters ice lolly, but it had white plastic sticks where the top half was like moulded into the shape of, you know, the Joker or Wonder Woman.
I remember
Woman or
those,
something.
Yeah, yeah.
And obviously at the time I was thinking, that's not fair, DC get everything. I want a Luke Cage or Black Widow lolly stick. But I remember a boy accidentally brandished some at the end of play. It's weird now. Do people use that phrase anymore? Play for mid-morning and mid-afternoon.
Yeah, it was called that at my school. Morning play and afternoon play, it was called.
Yes, yeah. A teacher saw them and confiscated them on the insistence that they were sharp. Now, the one thing they were not was sharp, completely round-edged in every way. Because, you know, the Riddler isn't very angular, is he?
No, I remember them, really, really well. Because I remember them having all the Batman characters in them. I do remember those. No, not remotely sharp. Literally just a bit of plastic. It's like in prison where people sharpen a toothbrush and cut someone's throat. They were lolly sticks, for God's sake.
And the other thing is, kids could be a bit, you know, on the one hand, yes, it's fun to join in with crazes. I will admit, I still have my Fanta yo-yo somewhere. But on the other, it is a bit kind of cheap-like. I always remember when something happened in Grange Hill, people would copy it the next day. And there was, I mean, this is ridiculousness in itself. I am fairly sure that it was Gonch and his associates surrounded Ziggy Greaves and covered his blazer in chalk. Which, you know, Ziggy would have battered them if a proper script writer was. Yeah. Anyway, the next thing that's sort of happening in school, I have a very vivid memory of some kids doing it to me and me just shouting, you absolute morons, you're doing this because of the little Grange Hill. Think of something yourself. I mean, it went straight in one ear and out the other with them, but I did feel that point needed to be made.
Yeah, that sort of thing used to really annoy me as well. I remember someone at my school asking our teacher if we could have a speaking wall like the one on Grange Hill. And I remember just thinking, you absolute idiot. Don't be ridiculous. Like, grow up. Like, be really... Like, of course we're not going to get that. It didn't even work in Grange Hill. Like, it really... As if that was ever going to happen.
That's a slight diversion. It did strike me recently. I was re-watching the episode of the Grange Hill where Danny Kendall proposed the speaking wall. And he stood in front of a wall with graffiti on it, school uniform. I suddenly realised how much it looked like the cover of Off the Wall by Michael Jackson.
Yeah, it really does. It really does.
No school in their right mind is going to implement that in real life. Why would you want it anyway?
As if. I mean, never in a million years. Never in a million years. The reference to Danny Kendall has reminded me that when I was in my first sort of proper job after university, it was a job in a PR firm in London, my colleague went to a meeting with a journalist who worked, I think, for the Daily Telegraph. off. And it was Danny Kendall. My colleague hadn't been warned about this. And he just sort of went like, oh no, you are Danny Kendall though, aren't you? Just like completely. And then he was like, yes I am, yes, right. Anyway, moving on. So that's what happened. He didn't really die in Mr. Bronson's car. He went on to have a career at the Telegraph.
Well, another Danny Kendall story. This is quite a long time ago. I went to see a band who probably nobody's heard of called Weird War, who were the new band of Ian Savonius, who was in a lot of sort of 90s indie band, American lo-fi indie bands like Nation of the Ulysses and The Makeup, okay, who people might have heard of. But he did a low-key tour of the UK with Weird War, who, it's a very weird thing. I thought they were absolutely brilliant live, and then I bought the album. I don't think I listened to it more than once.
Yeah.
It wasn't a bad album. It's just it didn't recreate the magic of seeing them live. But he had some kind of a rugby club blazer on. It was obviously his new look and the tie. He looked a bit like, you know, that bloke from Absolutely that John Sparks played. Halfway through the gig, somebody shouted, Danny Kendall wants his blazer back. And he just looked very confused for a second, this American, and then sort of drawled, yeah, I'd like to thank Mr. Kendall for lending me the blazer. He obviously had no idea what that was about. There's your culture clash for you.
There was a band that I went to see a few times in the sort of early 2000s called Mr. Big Adventure. The lead singer is no longer with us, sadly. He had a very sort of lugubrious, his sort of dark hair, very lugubrious 70s look, and he was always wearing flares. And I got very, very drunk at one of his gigs, and he said, any requests? And I shouted out the theme from Finger Bops. Because he really looked like Yoffie. And I would never normally shout anything out of a gig, but I must have been absolutely off my face because I went, do Finger Bobs. But at least he was British, so he did get the reference, to be fair. It wasn't like, if I'd have shouted that at an American, it would have just been really bizarre.
Well, the less said about the time I tried to impress one of Belle and Sebastian with my knowledge of Belle and Sebastian, the black and white TV series, the less said about that, the better, really. She wasn't impressed at all. So they remember the pressing engagement at the bar.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Snapper Crocodiles.
Yeah, back to the crocodiles.
I don't recall Danny Kendall ever having any, but they have disappeared completely, haven't they?
Yeah, when I was trying to do some research, I think I did find sort of like a, you know, like a kind of wholesalers that would sort of kind of sell them in a box of like 1,000 or something. So like I say, maybe for like a kid's party bag or something, but they are one of those things, I say, like those jointed plastic snake things that you used to be able to buy at, again, often in a zoo/seaside type gift shop. They were one of those things that were kind of really ubiquitous for a time. And then just sort of, I mean, who was making them? They weren't like a branded thing. Was there just one factory that was making them, or did loads of people make them? I don't know. They were everywhere for a while and then disappeared. And I say, you couldn't really do anything with them. They just made a really pleasing noise. But then I suppose a lot of kids' crazies don't really do much, do they? Like, they're just a sort of, a lot of those kind of cheap kids' crazies are just like a small tactile thing that you can sort of fiddle about with, really. So they kind of fulfilled that brief. But
and
yeah, you don't really
never
see them.
To know the provenance of them.
We'll never know their provenance. We'll never know from whence they came. I imagine my teachers from Kingshill Infant School are probably still furious about this.
So if you had the choice between a Snapper Crocodile being allowed to school and a speaking wall, what would you go for?
Oh, Snapper Crocodile. Yeah, any day of the week, Snapper Crocodile. Speaking wall would be awful. You'd just get like people writing really earnest things on it, and it'd be awful. No, I definitely would.
Or no, you'd write something on it, then you get some bloke saying, "Oh, verily, methinks thou dost be wrong."
I'd write something on it, and then some bloke would just come up and tell me why I'm wrong, or just rewrite it in a slightly different way that's not quite as funny. That's kind of what Twitter is, isn't it? It's just a speaking wall for our times.
Only instead of Imelda Davis, we get Elon Musk.
That's what it is.
And at least they diagnose her as a psychopath in the end.
Yeah, she was generally quite actually mentally unwell, wasn't she, Imelda? I always remember her putting fiberglass loft insulation down the back of Diggy's top.
Ah, me back! Yeah. Me back! Me back! Ah! Went on for about 20 minutes. Yeah. We're just talking about Grange Hill and never ending.
I know. The thing with Grange Hill is that because there were so many episodes and everybody watched every single one, it's just a never ending. Everyone's got memories, so many memories of it. Sorry, you had a point at which you could end and then we got sidetracked.
Well, I think we've still got plenty more to talk about. So who knows? You might be back soon and we might even mention Grange Hill again.
I'll try not to.
Joe, it's been brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, as always.
Keep Left, Swipe Right by Tim Worthington. Collected Thoughts from Uncollected Times and How I Kept Myself Sane and Didn't While the World Swung Off Its Hinges. Loss, Love, Lockdown, Laughter, Lying Politicians and lots of watching Agent Carter and Fist of Fun. More details at timworthington.org.